I'm Marty Moscowane. Welcome to Radio Times. There's a growing number of women who have been incarcerated in the United States, and a substantial portion of them are mothers. In fact, 250,000 children have a mom who is behind bars. According to the Marshall Project, 1 in 8 incarcerated parents lose their parental rights. Female inmates are more likely than male inmates to have their children in foster care and 5 times more likely to lose custody of their children altogether. The 20-year-old Adoption and Safe Families Act requires state child welfare programs funded by the federal government to begin termination of parental rights if the child has been in foster care 15 of the previous 22 months. Today, we want to talk about incarcerated mothers, parental rights, and the best practices for keeping the parent-child relationship strong. Also, why African-American mothers are particularly penalized by the criminal justice and foster care systems, and what is in the best interest of the child. We have 3 guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studio. Dorothy Roberts is a professor of law and sociology at the University of Pennsylvania, author of a number of books, including Shattered Bonds, The Color of Child Welfare, and a recent article titled Prison, Foster Care, and the Systemic Punishment of Black Mothers. Dorothy Roberts, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty.
You're welcome. Melissa Gamble is an advocate for incarcerated families who served on a number of state committees. She also served some time in prison and kept custody of her 2 children. Melissa Gamble, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And Kathleen Creamer is with us as well, and she's managing attorney of the Family Advocacy Unit at Community Legal Services here in Philadelphia. Kathleen Creamer, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good morning.
Good morning. Let me just put this, I'll put this first to you, Dorothy, but Melissa or Kathleen, you can jump in as well. Why are more women being incarcerated? They are the fastest growing segment of the prison population.
Well, it's part of the dramatic escalation of incarceration in the United States over the last 20 years. Everyone is more at risk of being incarcerated. But policies that used to give some empathy toward women because of motherhood have been changed. And also, it's more, there's more punishment of people for nonviolent crimes. So women are more likely to be incarcerated for nonviolent crimes as first-time offenders, for crimes that are related to poverty or to substance abuse or to other kinds of struggles that they have. They're often themselves victims of crime or other kinds of violence and abuse. And so because of a general, more punitive, carceral approach to people's problems in the United States, women have been sucked into that, and we see this dramatic escalation of female incarceration.
Do you see it that way, Kathleen?
Absolutely. And I think what we're seeing is women are being sucked into the epidemic of mass incarceration, but the rate at which we're incarcerating women is escalating at a rate that exceeds the rate at which we're incarcerating men. We know that that's not because there has been an outbreak of violence being committed by women in the streets, right? We have to look at why are we putting women in jail. The Pennsylvania Department of Corrections is actually expecting their population of incarcerated women to increase in the next couple of years, while they're expecting the population of incarcerated men to decrease. And we know that women do not go to jail for violent crimes. We know that
they're incarcerated. So we're talking about nonviolent crimes, largely speaking.
The vast majority of women who go to jail in this country and in this state are going to jail for nonviolent crimes.
What's a nonviolent crime? Just so our listeners know what it is we're talking about.
A nonviolent crime could be drug possession. It could be retail theft. What I see very often is my clients being arrested for what I kind of call a constellation of crimes that surround a drug addiction, right? So possession, use, small, petty thefts. Women are not violent. They're not going in the streets and committing violent acts. They're just not.
Mm-hmm. Right. Let me get you, Melissa, in on the conversation as well. And you served time in prison. It's been a number of years, I should say, to our listeners. For what kind of crime?
Wow.
And this goes back.
Yeah, I had received and stolen property, burglary general, pointed instrument of crime, manufacturing and delivering whatever they could put in there, it was in there. And that rate is 6 times. The women are going to jail 6 times faster than the men.
Faster than men. And how much time did you actually serve in prison then?
altogether, a total of 3 years. Right. Separately, 15 months.
So 15 months essentially in each place, or a little bit more than that. 3 years total in Pennsylvania?
Yes.
Right. And you have two children?
Yes, Alicia and Mary.
So when you were in prison, where were your children?
My children were, first, let me say this. When I was arrested, I was given 5 days to find somebody to come and get my kids. My family was on a family reunion. So I didn't know how to get in touch with them. They were in Charlotte, North Carolina. I had just come home not too long ago. So that went out the window. They sent me to Muncie.
Which is in Pennsylvania.
Which is in Pennsylvania.
Yep.
And when they sent me to Muncie, that's when I began to hear the stories from the other women. Like, they're going to take your kids, so you might as well just get ready for it and all of that kind of stuff. So, you know, me being who I am, I'm like, they're not taking my kids. They're not getting my kids. I like my kids. I need my kids, and they need me. So I heard the story that you get 15 to 22 months to get your kids back. And I had already sat in the county prison for 14 months. So I was already at the door. So I just stated, I'm not doing anything until you tell me what you did to my kids and what I can do to get them back. And that's how it happened. My kids went to foster care. I didn't get immediate letters or conversations with my kids, but I went to the parenting instructor in Muncie, and I stated that I needed to know what was happening with my kids. There was nothing that I could do for myself until I figured out what was happening with my kids. So the parenting instructor there, thanks to Creator for her, her name was Kearns Barr. She closed the door and she said, do you really want to get your kids? Do you really want to keep your kids? And I said, yes, I need my kids. My kids need me. And she said, well, this is what you need to do. Right. You need to write, and you need to keep writing. Even if you don't hear anything, you need to write. And that's what I did.
Right. And I want to pick up on your story, because also there was a foster mom that was helping you with your children and helping to maintain contact. But let me go back to you, Dorothy, because I read your article about prison foster care and the systemic punishment of Black mothers. And you talk about what happens oftentimes, and what we hear from Elisa, is moms lose their children.
Right, because as you mentioned, under the Adoption and Safe Families Act, there is the speeding up of the termination of parental rights, and many judges interpret children just being in foster care for an extended period of time as grounds for termination of parental rights. So because incarcerated mothers have a hard time, obviously, staying in touch with their children, meeting the other requirements that parents have to comply with in order to be reunified with their children, it's difficult for them to often maintain contact with their children, and therefore some judges will terminate their rights simply because their children have been in foster care for too long. And I think it's important to note, this is not because the mother doesn't love her children. It's not because the children don't need and would benefit from a bond with their mother. It's not even because the mother has shown that she's abusive or neglectful of her children. It's simply because
She's in prison.
And it has to do with the amount of time a child is in foster care. There is this philosophy that occurred at the time of the passing of the Adoption Safe Families Act that I think was fueled by the idea that there were too many Black children languishing in foster care, and the way to solve this problem was to terminate Black mothers' rights. In fact, advocates explicitly stated this in racial terms, and so-called free these children to be adopted. And so instead of thinking about the value of the continuing bonds between mothers and their children despite incarceration, there grew this assumption, this presumption, that just being separated from a mother because of incarceration was itself grounds for termination of parental rights.
Well, this raises a whole host of things. And Kathleen, let me put it to you. And I put the question out here truly. And it seems to me, and what I hear from you, Melissa, is that what is in the best interest of the children, that should really be the defining question that we have to figure out how to solve. And obviously, when a child doesn't see their parent or doesn't have any contact with their parent, the effect on them has got to be traumatic.
Absolutely. And I think that we are finally starting to have a conversation about the trauma of mass incarceration on children. It has been absent from a lot of the child welfare dialogue. With absolute gratitude and respect for Professor Roberts' work. For a long time, she was the only person saying this. And I'm glad we're finally beginning the conversation, because what we know for sure is that children experience losing a parent to incarceration as trauma.
No question.
That trauma is magnified when that parent was the primary caregiver. And what we know is that women who go to jail were, by and large, the primary caregiver for those children. So we have this kind of family separation, which we know is an extraordinary trauma. People who work with young children often liken the trauma of losing a mom to incarceration to the trauma of death. Because imagine from a young child's perspective, your mom is there one day, and the next day she's gone. Unfortunately, the interventions that we've offered in the child welfare system are not always responsive to that trauma, because what we know about trauma for children is that the best buffer we have, the best way to address trauma for young children is connection, right? Connection to their primary caregiver. Instead, the child welfare system has really invested in strategies of disconnection, right? Strategies of separating parents from children and strategies of breaking family bonds and really not working to maintain those family bonds during incarceration. And then, of course, when we talk about adoption, that is the ultimate disconnection, right?
Mm-hmm. Let me just pick up on the idea of connection is literally, and we heard this from Melissa, talking to your children, writing to your children, visiting the children. You're saying the system makes it impossible or hard to do that?
Well, let me first say that we are starting to have this conversation in Pennsylvania and in the city of Philadelphia. And there are good people in all of these systems who are starting to recognize that this isn't working for kids. And so we have seen progress. I've seen Philadelphia Department of Human Services try to invest more in training and supporting case managers as they do this very difficult work. Across the state, there's been amazing dialogue with the Administrative Office of Pennsylvania Courts, forming a work group that Melissa and I worked on together. So we are seeing progress happening, but it's slow, right? Mm-hmm. So the typical experience of a child who's in foster care, whose mother goes to jail, hasn't changed a whole lot in the last decade or so since Professor Roberts wrote her book. Two decades at this point,
yes,
right?
Exactly.
So what we see is, you know, barriers to maintaining family contact, right? And some of that is we're incarcerating kids very far away from their parents.
Well,
parents very far away from their kids.
Let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Kathleen Creamer. Also with us, Melissa Gamble and Dorothy Roberts as well. We are talking about incarcerated mothers, their children, parental rights, foster care. You can join us 1-888-477-9499. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, and we're talking about what happens to a child when their mother is sent to prison. Incarcerated mothers often lose parental rights, even when convicted of a minor or nonviolent crime. 250,000 children have a mother in prison, and as the number of incarcerated women continues to rise, what is the impact on families and their communities? Talking with Dorothy Roberts, a professor of law and sociology at the University of Pennsylvania, Kathleen Creamer, managing attorney of the Family Advocacy Unit at Community Legal Services here in Philadelphia. And Melissa Gamble, she's an advocate for incarcerated families, has served on a number of state committees and did spend about 3 years in prison as well. You can also join our conversation. I gave out the phone number. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Melissa, I want to turn back to you and just ask a little bit about the foster mom who took care of your girls when you were in prison. What was your relationship with her like? How did you work with her? How did she work with you to make sure that your kids stayed in contact with you?
Gwendolyn Morris, her name, beautiful spirit. How I got to, I used to write to the different people in the community. My kids didn't just go straight to Ms. Gwynn. They went to the archdiocese, who I wrote them and asked them if they could keep Alicia and Mary together because they were young and they had never been apart from each other. So they stated that the foster mother didn't want me to know where she lived, her address, her phone number, or anything at first. I kept writing the archdiocese, and they sent the letters to Ms. Gwynn. And then finally, one day, the mail called, and it was a letter from Ms. Gwynn.
Wow.
And she stated that it was okay for me to write the kids and don't call that much, but I can write. And I just kept writing. She sent pictures. She sent letters. And she sent me letters of encouragement to get myself together. And that's how we formed the bond. And I went to see her like maybe a few times after I got out, which was really good. And I believe my daughters, both of them, still go to see her.
Right. So she obviously played a critical part in maintaining this kind of relationship. Do you think she was just not testing you, but just wanting to make sure that you were going to be there for your kids?
I believe that's so. And I believe that the foster parents go through a lot also. From what I heard in the prison, I didn't witness this myself, but you hear the stories of the women and they're speaking about how bad the foster kids was. But I had to let my faith kick in and say that this woman is not going to hurt my kids and she's all I have right now. So once I knew that they were with her and the correspondence started, I could begin to work on myself.
But it sounds like, did you feel like you were doing this all by yourself, or were there people supporting you in trying to maintain contact with your kids?
The only people that I felt I had support with was my counselor, whose name was Lee Francik, and Kearns Barr, the parenting instructor at Muncie. Anything other than that, there was no prescriptive plan. There was nothing done. All of the cogs were definitely not going in the same direction. And when I came home, I went to a program when I came home, and the program got me to the courts to be in court that day. But nobody knew that I was home. The judge was ready to hit the gavel on the podium and say my kids were going up for adoption. And I'm like, no. The mother's not incarcerated. The mother's right here. And then things started to change. It was like a whole shuffling going on. I got an advocate that day. My kid's advocate was there. It was just so many people that I didn't even know existed.
And they were there for you.
And they were there for me.
And you kept custody of your children.
I had to go through some steps with with doing that. Like, my judge wanted to know what I was going to do, how I was going to do it. And he gave me 6 months to get myself together because, again, I just came home. And then he said, you come back in front of me. And 6 months I went back in front of him and he stated, it was so funny because he stated, well, I don't think that you made it. And my heart just sunk. And he said, I'm just kidding. You're going to get your kids back.
What's the name of this judge?
His name is Degrassi. Okay. I know he's in courtroom E.
Courtroom E. Okay.
All the details.
Wow. So, well, I'm really happy that you were able to you know, maintain a relationship with your children and obviously keep them as well. But, Dorothy, what we're hearing is that the system was against her.
That's right. Melissa was able to keep custody of her children because of her extra determination, but also because she was fortunate to have certain people who were on her side. But the system isn't structured that way, and it should be. So just initially, the very philosophy of incarceration and of the child welfare system are both based on punishing mothers for social conditions they live in that aren't their fault. So there's the philosophy of, instead of supporting these mothers and their children are placed in foster care or the mothers go to prison. So the very approach of punishment and policing and surveillance and accusation, you know, this is the philosophy of a system that's supposed to be to support family. So it's the opposite of that. So from the beginning, we need to change that philosophy. But then if we look at, well, then how are these systems structured to be able to allow families to stay together? It's it mostly is a bunch of obstacles to that. So if we could take Melissa's experience of being able to keep custody of her children, but make it structured into the way in which the systems operate, beginning with not placing so many children in foster care, not making foster care the solution to families' problems and struggles, but instead making family support the solution, and ending mass incarceration, ending the incarceration of mothers for nonviolent crimes. I mean, that's another program, but abolishing that whole approach. But then, even more immediately, we can have a better way of supporting families, ensuring that mothers can keep in touch with their children, and ending this practice of terminating parental rights just because of the time that parents spend in prison.
Time is a tricky thing, because when you're talking about young children, you know, 12 months and the age of a 3-year-old is you know, a substantial portion of that young child's life. I wonder, Kathleen Creamer, as you mentioned the fact that there is some progress here, at least in Philadelphia, you're beginning to see efforts to try to maintain this parental child contact. What's interesting, though, is when you look at statistics applied to male inmates, it's very different. And is that because when a father is in prison, the mother often will go to extra efforts to make sure that the children stay in contact, but when the mother's in prison, she doesn't get the same kind of treatment?
Well, that's certainly true. I mean, what we know from the data is that by and large, when dad goes to jail, the child doesn't experience a custodial disruption because she gets to stay with her mom, right? But when we see women going to jail, we often see family members picking up the slack and grandmothers and maternal relatives stepping up. But then we also see a really increased risk for foster care. And so what we know is that incarcerated women report experiencing having a child in the child welfare system at 5 times the rate of incarcerated men. And I want to talk a little bit about Melissa's experience.
Sure.
Because I want to highlight that her experience is actually rather extraordinary in this era of accelerated adoptions, because she did have more than 15 months to work on reunification with her daughters. And she was lucky that she had a team of support around her where people recognized that it really was in her children's best interest to go home with her. But what we're seeing kind of across the country is really strict adherence to this 15-month timeline without the kind of considerations that Melissa's family was provided with, without a real true analysis of, is this truly in the best interest of this child to forever sever her relationship with her mother, right? Instead, we see ASFA being applied, the Adoption Safe Families Act, being applied in a very rote and routine way, where we're just assuming that at 15 months, certainly permanent severance of the relationship is in the best interest of the child.
And if we could get to the bottom of why our society has this attitude that it would be okay to permanently sever this relationship, it's because of the devaluation of the mothers we're talking about. They're disproportionately Black mothers, disproportionately impoverished or cash poor mothers, and also stigmatized because they were incarcerated, despite the fact that their incarceration was for a nonviolent, often very petty crime that arose because of their own needs and perhaps their own victimization and surviving from all sorts of difficult situations. So we have to really examine who we value, whose relationships we value, whose family bonds are supported in America and whose aren't. And there are lots of parents who are more privileged, who are separated from their children, and no one says that they should permanently lose a relationship with their children. It's these mothers where their bonds aren't valued enough to support them.
Melissa, it looks like you want to say something.
I want to say that when you're told that you only have 15 to 22 months to get your kids back, and you've sat for 14 months and you haven't even seen the judge that you're supposed to see yet, never mind the judge that you have to see for your kids, that's like totally, totally shouldn't be happening. When you hear this, and then when you see the mothers that are at Muncie. I remember one time coming out onto the campus when I got myself situated, if you will, and I looked around and I see the sea of women, and I'm like, if all the mothers are here, who's home with the kids? Who's home with the kids? But these women, if you look at it, have been beat down by whatever took them to the system. And then they get into the system and they're beat down even more. And then the anger that is displayed in there about their kids, they begin to beat on each other. And then you're hearing or not hearing from the system, if you will. There's a problem with that, because I heard nothing from well, that's not exactly true. I heard one letter from the courts here in Philadelphia stating that I had this advocate, but I never saw him. I never talked to him after that. There was no prescriptive plan, but they were telling me that I had one. And the next letter I get was from the courts stating that my kids were going to be taken away if I didn't make it there on December the 17th. And thanks to the Creator, again, I was able to get there because the program that I came home to got me there in time, which was the Why Not Prosper program.
Well, and you mentioned the fact that when you were at Muncie Prison, that women were their moms who were there feeling as if they couldn't fight. And the fact that they didn't fight, then there was a greater chance they were going to lose their kids.
Absolutely. Some people, even some of the women even asked me, how come your social worker is writing you back? I haven't heard from mine. I said, I can't answer that question. Just keep writing. That's because that's the advice that Kearns Barr gave me. Right. If you don't hear anything, keep writing. Keep writing. I didn't just get a letter overnight. It took a while for me to get a letter, but I was writing everybody, my judge, my senators, everybody. I need my kids. I want my kids. You know, I'm going to get this right. That's what I kept saying.
You want to respond, Kathleen?
Yeah, I mean, I think what Melissa is experiencing is what I've always experienced anytime I go to a women's jail, which is that when you go to a women's jail, everybody wants to talk about their children, right? There is this profound sense of anxiety and loss and desolation and isolation that comes from being separated from your children. And absolutely, I've been to men's prisons, I've been to women's prisons. And what you see when you talk to women is they are profoundly affected by the separation from their children. And the amount of assistance that they get really varies widely. You never know. Some people get excellent assistance and then some get nothing. And Melissa's talking about, you know, no letters, no contact. And that still continues in America to be an experience that a lot of incarcerated women have.
Let me get Alexis from, looks like Doylestown, to join us on Radio Times. Alexis, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi
there.
Thanks so much.
You're
welcome. I was calling because I'm so sympathetic to this. I actually have a daughter that we've adopted through the foster care system in Philadelphia. And we have a different experience that it took. My daughter was born, and we had her 2 weeks right from the hospital, and it took 36 months for us to finally adopt her. And she actually had to do prison visits to the birth mother. Sometimes the mother would be in solitary confinement, and the first thing that this infant would have to do is go meet this mother, even though she hadn't been out of confinement for longer than 5 minutes. And they're not allowed to bring any items of comfort with them. And now my daughter's 7 and suffers from PTSD from these visits. And it took such a long time for us to adopt her. And what I found was that the birth parent actually had so many rights. I'm sure each case is very different. But in this case, it took a full 36 months for us to work through this.
And the birth mother was in prison or is in prison, Alexis?
She was in prison, and as I'm assuming that she might still be in prison, actually. It was for violent and nonviolent crime.
I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And, I mean, these are painful, complicated stories, and this is also real life. Kathleen, anything you want to say back to Alexis?
Yeah, I think that in terms of the time, we often see, in Philadelphia at least, time to termination of parental rights is within the guidelines that the federal government has created, but we see the time from termination to adoption taking a while for because of various delays. So I'm not super surprised to hear 36 months, but I want to address for a moment the visitation issue.
Absolutely.
So what we know, you know, my assumption is in this particular case, the case plan goal was reunification for quite a while. And what we know is when you are working on reunifying a family, there is nothing more important that you can do than connect the child and the mother, right? That the best predictor we have of whether a family will successfully reunify is whether visits occurred, right? And whether they occurred frequently and meaningfully. So visits are incredibly important. What we also know is we have work to do across the country and across the state of Pennsylvania in making visitation spaces more child-friendly, right? We do need to invest in making sure those visits are supportive and nurturing environments for children. And we haven't always succeeded, and we certainly have work to do. But what I would say is, given what we know about the importance of family connection for children, we have to focus on visits.
I mean, just seeing what Alexis said, and we're almost up in a break here. I mean, what she felt as the foster parent in this case, that the mother wasn't providing for the child, and what she saw was that these visits were upsetting to the child.
But the visits were in prison. What is the mother is incarcerated. So in order to maintain contact with her child, by definition, they have to be in the prison. And as Kathleen is saying, then the solution isn't to say, well, don't allow the child to visit the mother. The solution is to figure out a more welcoming, somehow within the prison, way to deal with these visits. Also,
Hold on to that thought, only because otherwise I'd have to jump in here talking with Dorothy Roberts, Melissa Gamble, and Kathleen Creamer about women in prison and their children and the child welfare system and foster care and all that comes with that. 1-888-477-9499. Alexis, thanks for your call. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We're talking about a number of things, including the fact that 250,000 children have a mother in prison in America. The number of incarcerated women continues to rise. In fact, it's the fastest growing segment of the prison population. We're talking about the impact on families, obviously on children, on moms, and also their communities. And let me just quickly reintroduce everybody. Kathleen Creamer, Managing Attorney of the Family Advocacy Unit at Community Legal Services here in Philadelphia. Melissa Gamble is an advocate for incarcerated families who has served on a number of state committees and spent some time in prison as well. She did, though, keep custody of her two children. And Dorothy Roberts, Professor of Law and Sociology at the University of Pennsylvania. And again, we want to hear from you, 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Dorothy, you wanted to say something right before the break.
Well, I just wanted to add that let's remember that mothers who are incarcerated have constitutional rights to a relationship with their children. So the prior caller said this mother had so many rights. Yes, she does have rights. Right? Just because she's incarcerated doesn't mean that she loses her constitutional right to a relationship with her children. It doesn't mean that her bond with her children isn't valuable. It doesn't mean that she's not a benefit to her children and that her children want to maintain a bond with her. So it's just important to remember that incarceration doesn't deprive people of their constitutional rights. To me, the solution would be to incarcerate fewer mothers in the first place, and then we wouldn't have this terrible problem of how to allow children to visit their mothers in prison.
Okay. And as Melissa said, I mean, she fought for her children and she was able to maintain custody of them. But it seems to me, Kathleen, I mean, there are people, including mothers, who are not good mothers, who and their children are better off with someone else adopting them or being their parent.
Well, certainly there are cases where adoption is the appropriate remedy. But what I think is very dangerous is that we in America have a presumption for adoption. And what we know about children, all children and all human beings is that we have a fundamental need to connect to our own families, right? And that need doesn't go away because your mother's incarcerated or because you're in foster care. And I think what Professor Roberts, when she talks about the kind of pathologizing of these families that happens, is that we disregard a child's fundamental need to connect to her own family. And so certainly adoption is a good option for some children. But what we know about child development is that adoption is often the worst option because it deprives children of that lifelong relationship with their mother. If we can't do reunification, the child welfare system presumes that the next step is closed adoption, meaning for a child, the promise of ASFA is we're going to put you in foster care. We'll make reasonable efforts, not too great efforts. We'll make them reasonable to put your family back together. And then at 15 months, you will never see your mother again. That is the strategy we are taking. And so we are investing in a strategy of disconnection for young children when we know that what they need is the opposite, a strategy of connection. In the private adoption arena, there is a presumption that adoption will be open, right? There is a presumption that children will have that need for lifelong contact honored. That does not happen in the child welfare system. We have a presumption for closed adoption. And again, I think it goes to the pathologizing of these mothers and their children and the need for them to connect to each other.
I do want to get some more callers, but I want to go back to you, Maylisa. What then was it like for you and your children when you were able to, in a sense, reunified, come together as a family?
It was a beautiful thing. And my kids weren't thinking about what I had done to go to prison. They were just glad that they were with their mother. I didn't parole home to Philadelphia. I paroled home to Montgomery County. And we didn't have, the judge asked about my business. I told him I was going to run my business. He said, do you have the things that you need? I said, no. So he made sure that the courts knew to get me a computer, a fax machine, and a printer. He said, that's going to help you along the way. He gave me a child advocate for myself and one for my daughters. They made sure that everything that I needed was there, but it was under the pretense of the kids. They bought everything for the house except my bedroom set. I had to buy my own. But my kids didn't care about all of that. We didn't have furniture when we first got there. I went to a yard sale and I bought pillows and a coffee table. And that's how we ate. That's how we did homework. That's how we did everything. And I am just thankful, and I am grateful today for my kids. We struggle sometimes now, but we get through it because they remember now what I did. And sometimes my baby daughter, Mary, she says certain things. Well, you aren't here for that, Mom. And that crushes
that
you.
I bet.
That in itself crushes you, but we're still together. And we get through it. And that's very, very important. And I wish that everybody could experience that.
Me too. I appreciate you saying that. Let me get Austin from Cherry Hill, New Jersey, to join us on Radio Times. Austin, go ahead. You're on the air.
I was wondering if there could be a comment made about the impact on the children who, especially with mothers with recidivism, being high, especially for drug and alcohol use, going in and out of prison, and how that affects the ability to reunify and create a permanent plan for the children. Because so often I see as a child protective service worker is that reunification is the plan and the goal, and parents that struggle with addiction will come out and then soon be incarcerated again, and then we have to sort of start all over.
Right, no, I hear you. I'm going to toss that to you, Dorothy. I'm curious about your thoughts, and also to you, Kathleen.
Yeah, well, part of the problem that's being raised is that there aren't supportive services for incarcerated mothers when they're released from prison, not enough. In fact, there are lots of barriers that are created by a conviction and incarceration, certain prohibitions for working in positions.
Housing
prohibitions. Just the stigma that incarceration creates that is a barrier to getting a job, and on and on and on. So we also have to be concerned about the supports for families after an incarcerated mother is released. And so it is a problem of recidivism, but that's because of lack of supports for the mother when she's released, and also because of this underlying problem of incarcerating people because they have health problems. Again, yes, the problem reasserts itself, but because of the harmful philosophy of incarceration to begin with. And if we had better policies about how to support people who have the health problem of substance abuse and also deal with the underlying causes of the abuse to begin with, we wouldn't have the problem of recidivism. Blaming the women who end up in prison for reasons that do not deserve prison time over and over again isn't the answer. It's getting to the root cause and changing our policies.
Kathleen, you want to add to that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we certainly do see recidivism happen. And I think it's important to contextualize what we're talking about when we're talking about mass incarceration, because we're not just talking about putting astronomical numbers of people in jails and prisons, we're talking about lifelong collateral consequences. And so what my office does, Community Legal Services is the largest civil legal aid provider in the city of Philadelphia. And half of the work that we are doing is cleaning up the mess caused by mass incarceration and helping people resolve all the collateral consequences that then become barriers to reentry and that also drive people back into jail. So all of the barriers that we see when a woman gets out, are choices that we're making. We are making these choices as a society to erect barriers instead of taking them down. And so I agree with Professor Roberts. When we say recidivism is a problem, absolutely it is. And it's a pathology on our part. It's not necessarily a pathology on the mother's part.
Yes, exactly.
Melissa, you want to add to that?
I wanted to say that I agree with not having the resources, because the program that the judge gave me is no longer in Philadelphia because they stated that it wasn't being used. Well, had the judge not told me about the program, right, I would never have known. And I don't think anybody ever knew. I mean, when you come home and they allot you this these resources, and then they're taken away before you tell somebody, and then before they could even hang up the phone, that program is gone out of the city. That's bad, because people who come home usually come home with nothing.
Right, and need supports. Austin, thanks for the call. Let me get Carolyn. Looks like Carolyn from Philadelphia to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Carolyn. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Marty.
Hi there.
I was the founder of the National Adoption Center and worked on the legislation that you're talking about. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important to know why that legislation was passed in Washington. And it was because children were being allowed to drift in foster care for years, maybe go back home, come back to foster care, different foster home, group home. And the idea was to look at the best interests of the children. And I don't think the intent ever was to remove children from parents who are adequately taking care or are making the steps necessary to get their children back home.
Well, Caroline, I appreciate the call, and I know our guests want to respond. I'm curious, Kathleen, what you say in response. I mean, she's saying the intent was to help the children who were bouncing around the system.
Of course. And I absolutely recognize that the Adoption and Safe Families Act was passed by people with good intent, people who cared about children. I'm certainly not maligning anybody who is trying to do something for children. But I think that ASFA was a very incomplete solution, and it was a solution that had a lot of unforeseen consequences. We were trying to address foster care drift, the idea of kids lingering in foster care for a long time. And so what we said, the strategy in 1997 when we passed ASPA was like, well, then let's just move those children quickly to adoption. What we didn't ask is, why are those children entering foster care in the first place? Why are we investing our resources in adoption rather than preventing unnecessary family separation? So ASPA was an investment in adoption and not at all an investment in preventing children from unnecessarily entering foster care.
Let me go back to you, Dorothy, because that's what you have been saying during the hour. So if not the criminal justice system, if a mother steals or is selling drugs, what do we do then? Say it's a first offense. What do?
We provide supports for the family because she's probably doing this nonviolent crime because of the needs of her family or because of a substance abuse problem where there are experts better than I who know how to deal with substance abuse. But getting to the struggles of people who are using drugs or engaging in petty nonviolent crimes is the way to address it, not by incarcerating more and more people. We know now that incarceration causes extreme harms to whole communities and families and individuals, and it is a bad answer to the problems that people have because of inequalities in our society. I see this whole thing structurally, you know, as a way of blaming the most marginalized people in our society. Who are we talking about here? We're talking about people who are living in poverty. We're talking disproportionately about mothers of color. And instead of providing the supports and the social changes, it's resources, but it requires deeper social structural changes. We're blaming them, taking their kids away from them, putting them in prison, and then saying, well, it's their fault that they can't be reunified with their children. Even the Adoption Safe Families Act, instead of asking, as Kathleen just said, why are all these children being removed? Why is it that they're lingering in foster care? Why are they going from one foster care placement to another? Instead, the answer is, well, let's just turn to more privileged people who we think are better parents and let them adopt these children instead. And as I mentioned earlier, it was promoted by racist messages that these are black children who are lingering, that their mothers don't deserve to have them back, and they should be freed from adoption in explicitly racial terms so that better families could take care of them. That is the problem here. It's the pathologizing these families as an excuse for not engaging in the deeper structural changes that we need for everybody in America.
Well, I wish we could go on. Elisa, I had a question for you, but we are out of time, and I appreciate all three of you joining us today, coming in. Dorothy Roberts, thank you so much, professor of law and sociology at the University of Pennsylvania. Melissa Gamble, thank you for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. She's an advocate for incarcerated families, and she has served on a number of state committees. Kathleen Creamer, thank you for coming in as well.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. And she's managing attorney of the Family Advocacy Unit at Community Legal Services here in Philadelphia. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to learn more about the program. You can also go to our Facebook page and become part of our listeners group, and just go to the bar there and write in Radio Times listeners, and we'll get you signed up. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you for joining us.